worldwide, a tiny fraction of the death rate in the age of mortality, and nowhere near enough to balance population growth. I shudder to think how many more scythes it would take, and how many gleanings would be required, if we ever need to curb population growth altogether. From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 13. Vernal Conclave. Fulcrum City was a post-mortal metropolis toward the very center of Mid-America. There, by the river, set low between the sky-soaring spires of graceful city living, was a venerable structure of stone, impressive if not in height, then in solidity. Marble columns and arches supported a great copper dome. It was an unyielding homage to ancient Greece and imperial Rome, the birthing grounds of civilization. It was still called the Capitol Building, for it was once a state capital, back when there were still states, in those days before government became obsolete. Now it had the honor of holding the administrative offices of the Mid-American Scythedom, as well as hosting its conclave 3 times a year. It was pouring rain the day of the vernal conclave. Citra rarely minded the rain, but a day of gloom coupled with a day of pure tension did not sit well with her. But then a bright sunny day would feel mocking. Citra realized there was no good day to be presented to an intimidating elegy of scythes. Fulcrum City was only an hour away by hypertrain, but of course, Scythe Faraday saw hypertrains as an unnecessary extravagance.
"Besides, I want scenery rather than a windowless subterranean tunnel. I'm a human being, not a mole."
A standard train took 6 hours, and Citra did enjoy the scenery along the way, although she spent most of the trip studying. Fulcrum City was on the Mississippi River. She recalled that there was once a giant silver arch on the riverbank, but it was gone now, destroyed back in the age of mortality by something called terrorism. She'd have learned more about the city if she weren't so focused on her poisons and weapons. They had arrived the evening before conclave and stayed in a downtown hotel. Morning came much too quickly. As Citra, Rowan, and Scythe Faraday walked from their hotel at the awful hour of 6:30 a.m., people in the streets ran to them and handed them umbrellas, choosing to get wet rather than see a scythe and his apprentices go without one.
"Do they know you've taken 2 apprentices instead of just one?"
Citra asked.
"Of course they know," said Rowan. "Why wouldn't they?"
But Scythe Faraday's silence on the matter was a clear red flag to Citra.
"You did clear it with the high blade, didn't you, Scythe Faraday?"
"I found that with the scythedom, it is better to ask forgiveness than permission," he told them.
Citra gave Rowan an "I told you so" look, and he cocked his umbrella slightly so he didn't have to see it.
"It will not be a problem,"
Faraday said. But he didn't sound very convincing. Citra looked to Rowan again, who was no longer eclipsed by his umbrella.
"Am I the only one who's worried about that?"
Rowan shrugged.
"We have immunity until winter conclave, and it can't be revoked. Everyone knows that. What's the worst they could do?"
Some scythes arrived at the Capitol Building on foot, as they had. Others in public cars, some in private cars, and several in limousines. There were ropes to hold back spectators on either side of the wide marble staircase leading up to the building, as well as peace officers and members of the Blade Guard, the Scythedom's elite security force. The arriving scythes were protected from their adoring public, even if the public was not protected from them.
"I despise running the gauntlet,"
Scythe Faraday said, referring to climbing the steps to the conclave.
"It's even worse when it's not raining. The crowd on either side is 12 people deep.
Now it was only half that.
It never occurred to Citra that people would come out to see scythes arriving at conclave.
But then all celebrity events drew onlookers, so why not a gathering of scythes? Some of the arriving scythes gave obligatory waves. Others played to the crowd, kissing babies and randomly granting immunity. Citra and Rowan followed Faraday's lead, which was to ignore the crowd completely. There were dozens of other scythes in the entry vestibule. They removed their raincoats to reveal robes of all colors, all textures. It was a rainbow that summoned forth anything but thoughts of death. This, Citra realized, was intentional. Scythes wished to be seen as the many facets of light, not of darkness. Through a grand arch lay a grander chamber beneath the central dome, a rotunda where hundreds of scythes greeted one another, engaging in casual conversation around an elaborate breakfast spread in the center. Citra wondered what it was that scythes talked about. The tools of gleaning? The weather? The chafing of their robes? It was intimidating enough to be in the presence of a single scythe. To be surrounded by hundreds was enough to make one crumble. Scythe Faraday leaned over and spoke to them in a hushed voice.
See there?
He pointed to a bald, heavily bearded man.
Scythe Archimedes, one of the world's oldest living scythes. He'll tell you he was there in the year of the Condor when the scythedom was first formed, but it's a lie. He's not that old. And over there...
He pointed to a woman, with long silver hair in a pale lavender robe.
That's Scythe Curie.
Citra gasped.
The Grand Dame of Death?
So they say.
Is it true she gleaned the last president before the Thunderhead was given control?
Citra asked.
And his cabinet, yes.
He looked at her. Perhaps a bit wistfully, Citra thought.
Her actions were quite controversial back in the day.
The woman caught them glancing her way and turned to them. Citra chilled when her piercing gray eyes zeroed in on her. Then the woman smiled at the three of them, nodded, and returned to her conversation. There was a group of four or five scythes closer to the assembly chamber entrance, the doors of which were still closed. They wore bright robes studded with gems. The center of their attention was a scythe in royal blue, whose robe contained what appeared to be diamonds. He said something, and the others laughed a little too heartily for it to be anything but sycophantic.
Who's that?
Citra asked.
Scythe Faraday's expression took a turn towards sour.
That,
he said, not even trying to hide his distaste,
is Scythe Goddard, and his company is best avoided.
Goddard? Isn't he the master of mass gleanings?
Rowan asked.
Faraday looked at him a bit concerned.
Where did you hear that?
Rowan shrugged.
I have a friend who's obsessed with that kind of stuff, and he hears things.
Citra gasped, realizing she had heard of Goddard, not by name, just by deed. Or, more accurately, rumor, because there was never any official report. But like Rowan said, you hear things.
Is he the one who gleaned an entire airplane?
Why?
Asked Faraday, giving her a cold, accusing eye.
Does that impress you?
Citra shook her head.
No. The opposite.
But she couldn't help but be a bit dazzled by the way the man's robes caught the light.
Everyone was, which must have been his intent. And yet his was not the most ostentatious robe on display. Moving through the crowd was a scythe in a lavishly gilded robe. The man was so large his robe seemed a bit like a golden tent.
Who's the fat guy?
Citra asked.
He looks important, said Rowan.
Indeed, said Scythe Faraday. The fat guy, as you call him, is the High Blade. The most powerful man in the Mid-American Scythedom, he presides over Conclave.
The High Blade worked the crowd like a great gaseous planet bending space around it. He could have tweaked his nanites to eliminate at least some of his girth, but clearly he had chosen not to. The choice was a bold statement, and his size made him an imposing figure. When he saw Faraday, he excused himself from his current conversation and made his way toward them.
Honorable Scythe Faraday, always a pleasure to see you.
He used both his hands to grip Faraday's in what was meant to be a heartfelt greeting, but felt forced and artificial.
Citra, Rowan, I'd like you to meet High Blade Xenocrates, Faraday said, then turned back to the large man. These are my new apprentices.
He took a moment to appraise them.
A double apprenticeship,
he said jovially. I believe that's a first. Most scythes have trouble with just one.
The better of the two shall receive my blessing for the ring.
And the other, said the High Blade, will be sorely disappointed, I'm sure.
Then he moved on to greet other scythes that were just now coming in from the rain.
See?
Rowan said.
And you were worried.
But to Citra, nothing about the man seemed sincere. Rowan was nervous, he just didn't want to admit it. He knew admitting it would make Citra more worried, which would make him more worried. So he bit back his fears and misgivings, and kept his eyes and ears open.
taking in everything that happened around him. There were other apprentices there. He overheard two talking about how this was the big day. A boy and a girl, both older than him, maybe 18 or 19, would be getting their rings today and become junior scythes. The girl lamented about how, for the first 4 years, they would have to get approval from the selection committee for their gleanings.
"Every single one," she complained, "like we're babies."
"At least the apprenticeship isn't 4 years long," Rowan interjected as a way to get into the conversation. The other two looked at him with mild disgust.
"I mean, it takes 4 years to get a college degree, right?"
Rowan knew he was just digging himself deeper, but he had already committed.
"At least it doesn't take that long to get a license to glean."
"Who the hell are you?"
the girl asked. "Ignore him. He's just a spat."
What?
Rowan had been called many things, but never that. They both smirked at him.
"Don't you know anything?" said the girl. "Spat, as in spatula. It's what they call new apprentices because you're not good for anything but flipping your scythe's burgers."
Rowan laughed at that, which just irritated them. Then Citra came up next to them.
"So if we're spatulas, what does that make you? Safety scissors? Or are you just a couple of tools?"
The boy looked like he might slug Citra.
"Who's your mentor, scythe?"
he asked her.
"He should be told of this disrespect."
"I am," said Faraday, putting his hand on Citra's shoulder. "And you don't warrant anyone's respect until after you receive your ring."
The boy seemed to shrink by about 3 inches.
"Honorable Scythe Faraday, I'm sorry, I didn't know."
The girl took a step away, as if to distance herself from him.
"Best of luck today," he told them with a magnanimous gesture that they didn't deserve.
"Thank you," said the girl. "But if I may say, luck plays no part. We've both trained long and have been taught well by our scythes."
"Very true," Faraday said.
They nodded respectful goodbyes that bordered on bows and left. After they were gone, Faraday turned to Rowan and Citra.
"The girl will get her ring today," he said. "The boy will be denied."
"How do you know?"
asked Rowan.
"I have friends on the bejeweling committee. The boy is smart, but too quick to anger. It's a fatal flaw that cannot be tolerated."
As annoying as Rowan found the kid, he couldn't help but feel a twinge of pity.
"What happens to the apprentices that get denied?"
"They are returned to their families, to take up life where they left off."
"But life can never be the same after a year of training to be a scythe," Rowan pointed out.
"True," said Faraday. "But only good can come from a keen understanding of what it takes to be a scythe."
Rowan nodded, but thought, for a man of such wisdom, that seemed very naive. Scythe training was a scarring endeavor. Purposefully so, but it was scarring nonetheless. The rotunda became increasingly crowded with scythes, and the marble walls, floor, and dome made voices echo into a cacophony. Rowan tried to hear more individual conversations, but they were lost in the din. Faraday told them that the great bronze doors to the assembly room would open promptly at 7 a.m., and the scythes would be dismissed at the stroke of 7 p.m. 12 hours to accomplish any and all business. Anything left undone would have to wait 4 months until the next conclave.
"In the early days," Scythe Faraday told them as the doors opened to admit the throng, "a conclave would last for 3 days, but they discovered that after the first day it became little more than arguments and posturing. There's still plenty of that, but it's curtailed. It behooves us all to move through the agenda quickly."
The chamber was a huge semicircle, with a large wooden rostrum at the front where the high blades sat, and slightly lower seats on either side for the conclave clerk, who kept records, and the parliamentarian, who interpreted rules and procedures if any questions arose. Scythe Faraday had told them enough about the power structure of the scythedom for Rowan to know that much. The first order of business, once everyone was settled, was the tolling of the names. One by one, in no particular order, the scythes came to the front to recite various names of people they had gleaned over the past 4 months.
"We can't recite them all," Scythe Faraday told them. "With over 300 scythes, it would be more than 26,000 names. We are to choose 10. The ones we most remember. The ones who died most valiantly. The ones whose lives were the most notable."
After each name was spoken, An iron bell was rung, solemn and resonant. Rowan was pleased to hear Scythe Faraday reciting Cole Whitlock's name as one of his chosen 10. The tolling of the names got old very quickly for Citra. Even reduced to 10 names each, the recitation lasted for almost 2 hours. It was noble that the Scythes saw fit to pay homage to the Gleaned. But if they only had 12 hours to complete 3 months' worth of business, she didn't see the sense of it. There was no written agenda, so there was no way for her and Rowan to know what came next, and Scythe Faraday only explained things as they happened.
"When is our test? Will we be taken somewhere else for it?"
Citra asked, but Faraday shushed her. After the tolling of the names, the next order of business was a ceremonial washing of the hands. The scythes all rose and lined up before 2 basins, one on either side of the rostrum. Again, Citra didn't see the point.
"All this ritual, it's like something you'd see in a tone cult,"
she said when Faraday returned to his seat, hands still damp. Faraday leaned over to her and whispered, "Don't let any of the other scythes hear you say that."
"Do you feel clean, after sticking your hands in water that 100 other hands have been in?"
Faraday sighed. "It brings solace. It binds us as a community. Do not belittle our traditions, because one day they may be yours."
"Or not,"
goaded Rowan. Citra shifted uncomfortably and grumbled,
"It just seems like a waste of time."
Faraday must have known her real gripe was with not knowing when they would be presented to the conclave and taken away for their test. Citra was not a girl who could endure being in the dark for long. Perhaps that's why Faraday made sure that she was. He was constantly poking at their weaknesses. Next, a number of scythes were singled out for showing bias in their gleanings. This held some interest for Citra, and gave her some insight as to how it all worked behind the scenes. One scythe had gleaned too few wealthy people. She was reprimanded, and assigned to only glean the rich between now and the next conclave. Another scythe was found to have racial ratio issues, high on the Hispanic, low on the Afric.
"It's due to the demographic where I live," he pleaded. "People have a higher percentage of Hispanic in their personal ratios."
Highblade Xenocrates was not swayed.
"Then cast a wider net," he said. "Glean elsewhere."
He was charged with bringing his ratios back into line, or face being disciplined, which consisted of having future gleanings pre-approved by the selection committee. Having one's freedom to glean taken away was a humiliation that no scythe wanted. 16 scythes were taken to task, 10 were warned, 6 were disciplined. The oddest situation was a scythe who was far too pretty for his own good. He got called out for gleaning too many unattractive people.
"What an idea," one of the other scythes shouted out. "Imagine what a world it would be if we gleaned only ugly people."
That brought a round of laughter from the rest of the room. The scythe tried to defend himself, claiming the old adage, "Beauty is in the eye of the beholder," but the High Blade wasn't buying it. This was apparently his 3rd such offense, so he was given permanent probation. He could live as a scythe, but could not glean.
"Until the next reptilian year," the High Blade proclaimed.
"That's crazy,"
Citra commented, just loud enough for Rowan and Faraday to hear.
"No one knows what animal's future years will be named after. I mean, the last reptilian year was the year of the gecko, and that was before I was born."
"Precisely," said Faraday, with a little bit of guilty glee, "which means his punishment could end next year, or never. Now he'll spend his time lobbying the office of the Calendaria to name a year after the skink or Gila monster, or some other reptile that has not yet been used."
Before they moved on from the disciplinary portion of the morning, there was one more scythe to be called out. It wasn't a matter of bias, however.
"I have before me an anonymous note," the High Blade said, "which accuses Honorable Scythe Goddard of malfeasance."
A rumble throughout the room. Citra saw Scythe Goddard whisper to his inner circle of companions, then stood.
"Of what sort of malfeasance am I being accused? Unnecessary cruelty in your gleaning. And yet this accusation comes anonymously," said Goddard. "I cannot believe that a fellow scythe would show such cowardice. I demand that the accuser reveal his or herself."
More rumbles around the room. No one stood up, No one took responsibility.
Well then, said Goddard, I refuse to answer to an invisible accuser.
Citra expected Highblade Xenocrates to press the issue. After all, an accusation from a fellow scythe should be taken seriously. But the Highblade put the paper down and said,
Well, if there is nothing more, we'll take our mid-morning break.
And the scythes, Earth's grand bringers of death, began to file out into the rotunda for donuts and coffee. Once they were in the rotunda, Faraday leaned close to Citra and Rowan and said, There was no anonymous accuser. I'm sure that Scythe Goddard accused himself.
Why would he do that?
Asked Citra.
To take the steam out of his enemies? It's the oldest trick in the book. Now anyone who accuses him will be assumed to be the cowardly, anonymous accuser. No one will go after him now.
Rowan found himself less interested in the stagecraft and parrying within the assembly room as he was in the things that went on outside of it. He was already getting a feeling for the scythedom and how it truly worked. The most important business did not occur within the bronze doors, but in the rotunda and dim alcoves of the building, of which there were many, probably for this exact purpose. The early morning conversations had been just small talk, but now, as the day progressed, Rowan could see a number of scythes congregating during break into small clatches, doing side deals, building alliances, pushing secret agendas. He overheard one group that was planning to propose a ban on remote detonators as a method of gleaning. Not for any ethical reason, but because the gun lobby had made a sizable contribution to a particular scythe. Another group was trying to groom one of the younger scythes for a position on the selection committee, so that he might sway gleaning choices when they needed those choices swayed. Power politics might have been a thing of the past elsewhere, but it was alive and seething in the scythedom. Their mentor did not join any of the plotters. Faraday remained solitary and above petty politics, as did perhaps half of the scythes.
We know the schemes of the schemers, he told Rowan and Citra as he negotiated a jelly donut. They only get their way when the rest of us want them to.
Rowan made a point to observe Scythe Goddard. Many scythes approached him to talk. Others grumbled about him under their breath. His entourage of junior scythes were a multicultural bunch, in the old school meaning of the word. While no one had pristine ethnogenetics anymore, his inner circle showed traits that leaned toward one ethnos or another. The girl in green seemed mildly Pan-Asian. The man in yellow had Afric leanings. The one in fiery orange was as Caucasoid as could be, and he himself leaned slightly toward the Spanic. He was clearly a scythe who wanted high visibility. Even his grand gesture of ethnic balance was a visible one. Although Goddard never turned to look, Rowan had the distinct feeling that he knew Rowan was watching him. For the rest of the morning, proposals were made and hotly debated in the assembly room. As Scythe Faraday had said, the schemers only prevailed when the more high-minded body of the scythedom allowed. The ban on remote detonators was adopted, not because of bribes from the gun lobby, but because blowing people up was determined to be crude, cruel, and beneath the scythedom. And the young scythe put forth for membership on the selection committee was voted down, because no one on that committee should be in anyone's pocket.
I should like to be on a scythe committee one day, Rowan said.
Citra looked at him oddly.
Why are you talking like Faraday?
Rowan shrugged.
When in Rome? We're not in Rome, she reminded him. If we were, we'd have a much cooler place for conclave.
Local restaurants vied for the chance to cater the conclave, so lunch was a buffet out in the rotunda, even more sumptuous than the one at breakfast. And Faraday packed his plate, which was out of character for him.
Don't think ill of him,
Scythe Kiri told Rowan and Citra. Her voice mellifluous, yet sharp at the same time.
For those of us who take our vow of austerity seriously, conclave is the only time we allow ourselves the luxury of fine food and drink. It reminds us that we're human.
Citra, who had a one-track mind, took this as her opportunity to get information.
When will the apprentices be tested?
She asked. Scythe Kiri smirked and brushed back her silky silver hair.
The ones who are hoping to receive their ring today were tested last night. As for all the others, you'll be tested soon enough, she said.
Citra's frustration made Rowan snicker, which earned him a glare from Citra.
Just shut up and stuff your face, she said.
Rowan was happy to oblige. As focused as Citra was on the upcoming test, she began to wonder what in Conclave she would miss when the apprentices were taken for testing. Like Rowan, she found Conclave to be an education like none other. There were few people beyond Scythes and their apprentices who ever witnessed this, and those others who did caught only a glimpse, such as the string of salespeople after lunch, who were each given 10 minutes to expound the virtues of some weapon or poison they were trying to sell to the Scythedom, and more importantly, the weapons master, who had the final decision over what the Scythedom purchased. They sounded like those awful people on info holograms. It dices, it slices, but wait, there's more. One salesperson was selling a digital poison that would turn the healing nanites in a person's bloodstream into hungry little bastards that would devour the victim from the inside out in less than a minute. He actually used the word victim, which immediately soured the scythes. He was flatly dismissed by the weapons master. The most successful salesperson was offering a product called Touch of Quietude, which sounded more like a feminine hygiene product than a death delivery system. The woman selling it displayed a small pill, but not to give the subject. The pill was for the scythe.
Take with water, and within seconds your fingers will secrete a transdermal poison. Anyone you touch for the next hour will be instantly and painlessly gleaned.
The weapons master was so impressed he came up to the stage to take a dose, then, in the ultimate demonstration, proceeded to glean the saleswoman. She sold 50 vials of the stuff to the scythedom, posthumously. The rest of the afternoon consisted of more discussion, arguments, and votes about policy. Scythe Faraday only found fit to voice his opinion once, when it came to forming an immunity committee.
It seems clear to me that there should be oversight for the granting of immunity, just as the selection committee provides oversight for gleaning.
Rowan and Citra were pleased to see that his opinion carried a great deal of weight. Several scythes who had initially voted against the forming of an immunity committee switched their vote. However, before a final tally was taken, Highblade Xenocrates announced that time had run out for legislative issues.
The subject will be at the top of our agenda for the next conclave, he announced.
A number of scythes applauded, but several rose up and shouted their grievous discontent at the issue being tabled. Scythe Faraday did not voice his own displeasure. He took a long breath in and out.
Interesting, is all he said.
This might have all pinged loudly on Rowan and Citra's radar, had the Highblade not immediately announced that the next order of business was the apprentices. Citra found herself wanting to grip Rowan's hand in anticipation and squeeze it until it was bloodless, but she restrained herself. Rowan, on the other hand, followed his mentor's lead. He took a deep breath in, then out, and tried to let his anxiety wash from him. He had studied all he could study, learned all he could learn. He would do the best he could do. If he failed today, there would be more than enough chances to redeem himself.
Good luck, Rowan said to Citra. You too, she returned. Let's make Scythe Faraday proud.
Rowan smiled and thought that Faraday might smile at Citra as well, but he didn't. He just kept his gaze on Xenocrates. First, the candidates for Scythedom were called up. There were 4 whose apprenticeship was now complete. Having had their final test the evening before, there was nothing left but to ordain them. Or not, as the case may be. Word was there was a 5th candidate who had failed the final test last night. He or she wasn't even invited to conclave. 3 rings were brought out, resting on red velvet pillows. The 4 looked to one another now, aware that even though they had passed their final test, one of them would not be ordained, and would be sent home in shame. Scythe Faraday turned to the scythe beside him and said,
Only 1 scythe gleaned himself since last conclave, and yet 3 are being confirmed today. Has the population grown so drastically in 3 months that we need 2 additional scythes?
The 3 chosen apprentices were called one by one by Scythe Mandela, who presided over the bejeweling committee. As each knelt before him, he said something about each of them in turn, and then handed them their rings, which they slipped on their fingers and held to show the conclave, which responded for each of them with obligatory applause. Then they announced their patron historic, the luminary from history, whom they would name themselves after. The conclave applauded with each announcement, accepting Scythes Goodall, Schrödinger, and Colbert into the Mid-American Scythedom. When the three had left the stage, the hot-tempered boy remained, just as Scythe Faraday had said earlier in the day. He stood alone after the applause died down. Then Scythe Mandela said,
"Ransom Paladini, we have chosen not to ordain you as a scythe. Wherever life leads you, we wish you well. You are dismissed."
He lingered for a few moments, as if thinking it might be a joke, or maybe one final test. Then his lips pursed, his face turned red, and he strode quickly up the center aisle in silence, pushing through the heavy bronze doors, their hinges complaining at his exit.
"How awful," said Citra. "At least they could applaud him for trying."
"There are no accolades for the unworthy," Faraday said.
"One of us will exit that way," Rowan pointed out to her. He resolved that if it was him, he would take his time going down that aisle. He'd make eye contact and nod to as many scythes as he could on his way out. Were he to be ejected, he would leave that final conclave with dignity.
"The remaining apprentices may now come forward," said Xenocrates.
Rowan and Citra rose, ready to face whatever the scythedom had in store for them.
"I do believe people still fear death, but only 1/100th as much as they used to. I say that because, based on current quotas, a person's chance of being gleaned within the next 100 years is only 1%, which means the chance that a child born today will be gleaned between now and their 5,000th year on Earth is only 50%. Of course, since we no longer count the years numerically, aside from children and adolescents, no one knows how old anyone is anymore, sometimes not even themselves. These days, people roughly know within a decade or two. At the writing of this, I can tell you that I am somewhere between 160 and 180 years old, although I don't enjoy looking my age. Like everyone else, I turn the corner on occasion and set my biological age back substantially. But like many scythes, I don't set it back past the age of 40. Only scythes that are actually young like to look young. To date, the oldest living human being is somewhere around 300, but only because we are still so close to the age of mortality. I wonder what life will be like a millennium from now, when the average age will be nearer to 1,000. Will we all be Renaissance children, skilled at every art and science because we've had the time to master them? Or will boredom and slavish routine plague us even more than it does today, giving us less of a reason to live limitless lives? I dream of the former, but suspect the latter.
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 14. A Slight Stipulation. Rowan stepped on Citra's toes on his way to the aisle. She grunted slightly, but didn't wisecrack about it. That was because Citra was too busy going over her weapons and poisons in her head. Rowan's clumsiness was the least of her concerns. She thought they would be led to a room elsewhere in the building, a quiet place for their exam. But other apprentices, who had been to Conclave before, were heading down the aisle toward the open space in front of the rostrum. They lined up in what seemed like no particular order, facing the Conclave like a chorus line. So Citra joined the line next to Rowan.
"What is this?"
she whispered.
"Not sure," he whispered back.
There were 8 in total. Some stood with hard expressions, in control of their emotions. Others were trying not to look terrified. Citra wasn't sure what image she projected, and found herself annoyed that Rowan looked as casual as if he were waiting for a bus.
"Honorable Scythe Curie will be the examiner today," Xenocrates said.
A hush fell over the chamber, as Scythe Curie, the Grand Dame of Death, came forward. She walked down the line of apprentices twice, sizing them up. Then she said,
"Each of you will be asked one question. You will have one opportunity to give an acceptable answer."
One question? What kind of exam could possibly consist of one question? How could they test anyone's knowledge that way? Citra's heart beat so violently she imagined it bursting out of her chest. Then she would find herself waking up in a revival center tomorrow, a laughingstock. Scythe Curie began at the left end of the line. It meant Citra would be fourth to be questioned.
"Jackery Zimmerman,"
Scythe Curie said to the gangly boy on the end.
"A woman hurls herself on your blade, offering herself as sacrifice to prevent you from gleaning her child, and dies. What do you do?
The boy hesitated for just an instant, then said,
By resisting the gleaning, she has violated the third commandment. I therefore am obligated to glean the rest of her family.
Scythe Curia was silent for a moment, then said,
Not an acceptable answer.
But,
said Jackery,
she resisted. The rule says,
if one resists one's own gleaning, were she the chosen one, the third commandment would most certainly apply. But if we are ever unsure, we are obliged to err on the side of compassion. In this case, you would glean the child and arrange for the woman to be brought to a revival center, granting her a year of immunity along with the rest of the family.
Then she gestured toward the assembly. Step down. Your sponsoring scythe will choose your punishment.
Citra swallowed. Shouldn't the punishment for failure be the awful knowledge of that failure? What sort of punishments would scythes devise for their disgraced disciples?
Scythe Curie moved on to a strong-looking girl with high cheekbones, on a face that looked like it could weather a hurricane.
Claudette Catalino, Scythe Curie said. You have made a mistake in your poison. That would never happen.
Claudette said.
Do not interrupt me. But your premise is flawed, Honorable Scythe Curie. I know my poisons so well, I could never make a mistake. Ever.
Well,
said Curie with deadpan irony,
how proud your sponsoring scythe must be to have the first perfect pupil in human history.
It brought forth a smattering of chuckles from the room.
All right, then, continued Scythe Curie. Let us say that someone irritated by your arrogance has sabotaged your poison. Your subject, a man who offered you no resistance, begins to convulse, and it appears that his end will be slow and likely filled with much more pain than his nanites can suppress. What do you do?
And without hesitation, Claudette said,
I draw the pistol that I always keep for emergencies and end the subject's suffering with a single well-placed bullet. But first I would order any family members to leave the room, sparing them the trauma of witnessing a ballistic gleaning.
Scythe Curie raised her eyebrows, considering the response, and said,
Acceptable. And thinking of the family is a nice touch, even in a hypothetical.
Then she grinned.
I'm disappointed. I couldn't prove you imperfect.
Next was a boy whose gaze was fixed on a spot on the back wall, clearly trying to find his happy place.
Noah Zbarsky, said Curie.
Yes, Your Honor.
His voice quivered. Citra wondered what sort of response that might evoke from Curie, what sort of question she might ask a boy so frightened.
Name for me 5 species that generate neurotoxins powerful enough to be effective on a poison-tipped dart.
The boy, who had been holding his breath, exhaled with loud relief.
Well, Phyllobates auritania, of course, better known as the poison dart frog, he said. The blue-ringed octopus, the marbled cone snail, the inland taipan snake, and, the deathstalker scorpion.
Excellent,
Scythe Curie said.
Can you name any more?
Yes,
Noah told her.
But you said one question. And what if I tell you I've changed my mind, and I want 6 instead of 5?
Noah took a deep breath, but didn't hold it.
Then I would tell you, in a most respectful way, that you were not honoring your word, and a scythe is duty-bound to honor their word.
Scythe Curie smiled.
Acceptable answer. Very good.
And then she moved on to Citra.
Citra Terranova.
She had realized the scythe knew everyone's name, and yet it came as a shock to hear her say it.
Yes, Honorable Scythe Curie.
The woman leaned in close, peering deeply into Citra's eyes.
What is the worst thing you have ever done?
Citra was prepared for just about any question. Any question but that one.
Excuse me?
It's a simple question, dear. What is the worst thing you've ever done?
Citra's jaw clenched. Her mouth went dry. She knew the answer. She didn't even have to think about it.
Can I have a moment?
Take your time.
Then some random scythe in the audience heckled.
She's done so many terrible things, she's having trouble selecting just one.
Laughter everywhere. In that moment, she hated them all. Citra held eye contact with Scythe Curie. Those all-seeing gray eyes. She knew she couldn't back away from the question.
When I was 8, she began, I tripped a girl down the stairs. She broke her neck and had to spend 3 days at a revival center. I never told her that it was me. That's the worst thing I ever did.
Scythe Curie nodded and offered a sympathetic grin, then said, You're lying, dear. She turned to the crowd, shaking her head, perhaps a bit sadly.
Unacceptable answer.
Then she turned back to Citra.
Step down, she said. Scythe Faraday will choose your punishment.
She didn't argue. She didn't insist that she was telling the truth, because she wasn't. She had no idea how Scythe Curie knew. Citra went back to her place, unable to look at Scythe Faraday, and he said nothing to her. Then Scythe Curie moved on to Rowan, who seemed so smug Citra just wanted to hit him.
Rowan Damish, Scythe Curie asked, what do you fear? What do you fear above all else?
Rowan did not hesitate in his response. He shrugged and said, I don't fear anything. Citra wasn't sure she heard him right.
Did he say he didn't fear anything? Had he lost his mind? Perhaps you want to take some time before answering?
Scythe Curie prompted. But Rowan just shook his head.
I don't need any more time. That's my answer. Not going to change it.
Absolute silence in the room. Citra found herself involuntarily shaking her head. And then she realized he was doing this for her, so she wouldn't have to suffer alone through whatever punishment was in store. So she wouldn't feel she had fallen behind him. Although she still wanted to smack him, now it was for an entirely different reason.
So, said Scythe Curie, today we have one perfect apprentice, and one fearless one.
She sighed.
But I'm afraid that no one is entirely fearless. So your answer, as I'm sure you must know, is unacceptable.
She waited, perhaps thinking Rowan might respond to that, but he did not. He just waited for her to say,
Step down. Scythe Faraday will choose your punishment.
Rowan returned to his place next to Citra, as nonchalant as could be.
You're an idiot, she whispered to him.
He gave her the same shrug he gave Scythe Curie.
Guess so. You think I don't know why you did that?
Maybe I did it so I'll look better at the next conclave.
Maybe. If I gave too good an answer today, my next question would be harder.
But Citra knew it was false, faulty logic. Rowan didn't think that way. And then Scythe Faraday spoke up, his voice quiet and measured, but somehow carrying an intensity that was chilling.
You shouldn't have done that.
I'll accept whatever punishment you see fit, Rowan said.
It's not about the punishment, he snapped.
By now, Scythe Curie had questioned a few more apprentices. One was sent to sit, two others stayed.
Maybe Scythe Curie will see what I did as noble, Rowan suggested.
Yes, and so will everyone else, Faraday said. Motives can easily be beaten into weapons.
Which proves, Citra said to Rowan, that you're an idiot.
But he only grinned, idiotically. She thought she had the last word on the matter, and that it was over until they returned home, where, no doubt, Scythe Faraday would inflict some annoying, but fair punishment that fit the crime. She was mistaken. After the apprentices were done being traumatized, the focus of the scythes began to wear down. There was now a constant murmur as scythes discussed dinner plans as the hour approached 7. The remaining business was of little interest to anyone. Issues of building maintenance and whether or not scythes should be required to announce the turning of a corner, so it wasn't so shocking when they looked 30 years younger at the next conclave. It was as things were wrapping up that one scythe stood up and loudly addressed Xenocrates. She was the one dressed in green, with emeralds embroidered into her robe. One of Scythe Goddard's bunch.
Excuse me, Your Excellency, she began,
although clearly she was speaking to the entire assembly, not just the High Blade.
I'm finding myself troubled by the set of new apprentices. More specifically, the apprentices taken on by Honorable Scythe Faraday.
Both Citron and Rowan looked up. Faraday did not. He seemed frozen, looking downward almost in meditation, or perhaps steeling himself for what was to come.
To the best of my knowledge, a scythe has never taken on two apprentices and set them in competition for the ring,
she continued. Xenocrates looked over to the parliamentarian, who had jurisdiction in such matters.
There's no law against it, Scythe Rand, said the parliamentarian.
Yes, Scythe Rand continued, but clearly the competition has turned into camaraderie. How will we ever know which is the better candidate if they continue to aid each other?
Your complaint is duly noted, said Xenocrates,
but Scythe Rand was not done.
I propose that to ensure this competition is truly a competition, we add a slight stipulation.
Scythe Faraday rose to his feet as if launched from his chair.
I object, he shouted. This conclave cannot stipulate how I train my apprentices. It is my sole right to teach them, train them, and discipline them.
Rand held up her hands in a gesture of mock magnanimity.
I merely seek to make your ultimate choice fair and honest.
Do you think you can beguile this conclave with your baubles and vanity? We are not so base as to be dazzled by shiny things. What is your proposal, Scythe Rand?
Asked Xenocrates.
I object, shouted Faraday. You can't object to something she has not said yet.
Faraday bit down his objection and waited. Citra watched, feeling almost detached, as if this were a tennis match and it was a match point. But she wasn't an observer, was she? She was the ball. And so was Rowan.
I propose,
said Scythe Rand with the slickness of a Deathstalker scorpion,
that upon the confirmation of the winner, the first order of business will be for that winner to glean the loser.
Gasps and grumbles from around the room, and Citra couldn't believe it. Some laughter and affirmations as well. She wanted to believe the woman in green could not be serious, that this was yet another level of the test. Faraday was so beside himself, he said nothing at first. He couldn't even find the words to object. Finally, he thundered his fury like a force of nature, a wave pounding the shore.
This flies in the face of everything we are, everything we do. We are in the business of gleaning, but you and Scythe Goddard and all of his disciples, you would turn this into a blood sport.
Nonsense, said Rand. It makes perfect sense. The threat of gleaning will ensure that the best applicant comes out on top.
And then, rather than striking it down as ridiculous, to Citra's horror, Xenocrates turned to the parliamentarian.
Is there a rule against it?
The parliamentarian considered and said,
since there is no precedent for the treatment of a double apprenticeship, there are no rules as to how it should be dealt with. The proposal is within our guidelines.
Guidelines!
Shouted Scythe Faraday.
Guidelines! The moral fabric of the Scythedom should be our guidelines. To even consider this is barbaric. Oh, please,
said Xenocrates with an exaggerated sweep of his hand.
Spare us all the melodrama, Faraday. This is, after all, the consequence of your decision to take on two apprentices, when one would have been sufficient.
Then the clock began to strike 7 o'clock.
I demand a full debate and vote on this,
Scythe Faraday pleaded, but 3 bells had already rung, and Xenocrates ignored him.
As is my prerogative as High Blade, I so stipulate that in the matter of Rowan Damish and Citra Terranova, whomever shall prevail will be required to glean the other upon receipt of his or her ring.
Then he banged his gavel heavily upon the rostrum, adjourning conclave and sealing their fate. There are times I long for a relationship with the Thunderhead. I suppose we always want what we can't have. Others can call on the Thunderhead for advice, ask it to resolve disputes. Some rely on it as a confidant, for it's known to have a compassionate, impartial ear and never gossips. The Thunderhead is the world's best listener. But not for Scythes. For us, the Thunderhead is eternally silent. We have full access to its wealth of knowledge, of course. The Scythedom uses the Thunderhead for countless tasks. But to us, it's simply a database. A tool, nothing more. As an entity, as a mind, the Thunderhead does not exist for us. And yet it does, and we know it. Estrangement from the collective consciousness of humanity's wisdom
is just one more thing that sets scythes apart from others. The Thunderhead must see us. It must be aware of the scythedom's petty bickering and growing corruption, even though it has pledged non-interference. Does it despise us scythes, but abides us because it has to? Or does it simply choose not to think of us at all? And which is worse, to be despised or to be ignored?
From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Curie. 15. The Space Between. The night was bleak, and rain streaked the windows of the train, distorting the lights beyond, until the lights were gone. Rowan knew they were slicing through the countryside now, but the darkness could have been the airless expanse of space.
"I won't do it,"
Citra finally said, breaking the silence that had engulfed them since leaving Conclave.
"They can't make me do it."
Faraday didn't say a word, didn't even look at her. So Rowan took it upon himself to answer.
"Yes, they can."
Finally, Faraday looked to them. "Rowan is right," he said. "They will find whatever button will make you dance. And dance you will, no matter how hideous the tune." Citra kicked the empty seat in front of her.
"How could they be so awful? And why do they hate us so much?"
"It's not all of them," Rowan said.
"And I don't think it's really about us."
Clearly, Faraday was a respected scythe. And although he didn't come out against Goddard today, his feelings about the man were clear. Goddard must see Faraday as a threat. Attacking Rowan and Citra was a warning shot.
"What if we both fail?" Citra suggested. "If we're lousy apprentices, then they can't choose either of us."
"And yet they will,"
Faraday told her with an authority and finality that left little room for doubt.
"No matter how poorly you perform, they will still choose one of you. For the spectacle alone."
Then he scowled in disgust. "And to set the precedent."
"I'll bet Goddard has enough friends to make sure it happens," said Rowan. "I think he has the High Blade on his side, too."
"Indeed," Faraday said with a world-weary sigh. "Never before have there been so many wheels within wheels in the Scythedom."
Rowan closed his eyes, wishing he could close his mind as well and hide from his own thoughts.
"In 8 months, I will be killed by Citra," he thought. "Or I will kill her."
And calling it gleaning didn't change the fact of what it was. He cared for Citra. But enough to surrender his life and let her win? Citra certainly wouldn't back down to let him earn the ring. When he opened his eyes, he caught her staring at him. She didn't look away.
"Rowan,"
she said.
"Whatever happens, I want you to know—"
"Don't," Rowan told her.
"Just don't."
And the rest of the ride was in silence. Citra, who was not the heaviest sleeper, found herself awake all night after they arrived home. Images of the scythes she saw at Conclave filled even the hint of dreams, jarring her back to unwanted wakefulness. The wise ones, the schemers, the compassionate, and those who did not seem to care. Such a delicate charge as pruning the human race should not be subject to the quirks of personality. Scythes were supposed to be above the petty, just as they were above the law. Faraday certainly was. If she became a scythe, she would follow his lead. And if she didn't become one, it wouldn't matter, because she'd be dead. Perhaps there was some sort of twisted wisdom in the decision to have one of them gleaned by the other. Whoever wins will begin their life as a scythe in abject sorrow, never to forget the cost of that ring. Morning came with no great fanfare. It was just an ordinary day, like any other. The rain had passed, and the sun peeked from behind shifting clouds. It was Rowan's turn to make breakfast, eggs and hash browns. He never cooked the potatoes long enough. Hash pails, Citra always called them. Faraday never complained when the meals they made were subpar. He ate what they served, and didn't tolerate complaints from either of them. The punishment for making something barely edible was having to eat it yourself. Citra ate, even though she didn't have an appetite, even though the whole world had slid off its axis. Breakfast was breakfast. How dare it be? When Faraday broke the silence, it felt like a brick flying through the window.
"I will go out alone today. The two of you will attend to your studies.
Yes, Scythe Faraday,
Citra said, with Rowan saying the same in a half-second echo.
For you, nothing has changed.
Citra looked down into her cereal. It was Rowan who dared to state the obvious.
Everything has changed, sir.
And then Faraday said something enigmatic that would only resonate with them much later.
Perhaps everything will change again.
And then he left them. The space between Rowan and Citra had quickly become a minefield, a dangerous no-man's land that promised nothing but misery. It was hard enough to negotiate with Scythe Faraday there, but his absence left the two of them with no one to mediate the space between. Rowan stayed in his room, studying there rather than going into the weapons room, which would feel painfully wrong without Citra sitting with him. Still, he kept his door cracked on the faint hope that she'd want to bridge the distance. He heard her leave, probably for a run, and she was gone for a good long time. Her way of dealing with the dark discomfort of their new situation was to remove herself from it even more completely than Rowan had. After she returned, Rowan knew there would be no peace between them, or within himself, unless he took the first step into that minefield. He stood outside her closed door for at least a full minute before he worked up the nerve to knock.
"What do you want?"
she asked, her voice muffled by the closed door.
"Can I come in? It's not locked."
He turned the knob and slowly opened the door. She was in the middle of the room with a hunting knife, practicing bladecraft against the empty air, as if battling ghosts.
"Nice technique,"
Rowan said. Then added,
"If you're planning on gleaning a pack of angry wolves." "Skill is skill, whether you use it or not."
She sheathed the blade, tossed it on her desk, and put her hands on her hips.
"So, what do you want?"
"I just wanted to say I'm sorry for shutting you down before."
"On the train, I mean."
Citra shrugged.
"I was babbling. You were right to shut me up."
The moment began to get awkward, so Rowan just went for it.
"Should we talk about this?"
She turned away from him and sat on her bed, picking up a book on anatomy and opening it as if she was about to start studying. She hadn't yet realized she was holding it upside down.
"What's to talk about? I kill you or you kill me. Either way, I don't want to think about it until I have to."
She glanced at the open book, turned it right side up, and then gave up the charade completely, closing it and tossing it to the floor.
"I just want to be left alone, okay?"
Even so, Rowan sat on the edge of her bed, and when she didn't tell him to go, he shifted a little bit closer. She watched him, but said nothing. He wanted to reach for her, maybe touch her cheek. But thinking about that made him think of the saleswoman who was gleaned by a touch. What a perverse poison that was. Rowan wanted to kiss her. There was no denying that anymore. He had suppressed the urge for weeks because he knew it would not be tolerated by the Scythe. But Faraday wasn't there, and the turmoil they had both been hurled into had washed all bets off the table. Then, to his surprise, she suddenly lurched forward and kissed him, catching him completely off guard.
"There," she said. "We've done it. Now it's out of the way and you can leave."
"What if I don't want to?" And she hesitated, long enough to make it clear that staying was a distinct possibility. But in the end she said,
"What good would it do, really, for either of us?"
She moved farther away on the bed, bringing her knees to her chest.
"I haven't fallen in love with you, Rowan. And now I want to keep it that way."
Rowan got up and moved to the safety of the threshold before turning back to her.
"It's all right, Citra,"
he told her.
"I haven't fallen in love with you, either."
I am not a man easily brought to fury, but how dare the old guard Scythes presume to dictate my behavior? Let every last one of them glean themselves, and we can be done with their self-loathing, sanctimonious ways. I am a man who chooses to glean with pride, not shame. I choose to embrace life even as I deal death. Make no mistake, we Scythes are above the law because we deserve to be. I see a day when new Scythes will be chosen not because of some esoteric moral high ground, but because they enjoy the taking of life. After all, this is a perfect world. And in a perfect world, don't we all have the right to love what we do? From the Gleaning Journal of H.S. Goddard.
16.
pool boy. There was a scythe at the door of the executive's mansion, actually a quartet.